We're live here with a Tidbit staff in yet another hangout. I have a different kind of topic today, nothing specifically newsy or timely, or maybe it is. I've been thinking a lot, coming back from Macworld Expo, about what it is that makes people loyal to Apple. That, let's face it, this is a kind of an unusual situation where a company, for-profit company that whose goal is to make money, has engendered just such vast amounts of loyalty among its customer base. And this started obviously, lots and lots and lots of years ago with very different products than where we are now, very different company from where we are now. Apple, has gone from being beleaguered Apple, news, Apple beleaguered, news at 11, down to the point where they are, perhaps the most valuable company in the world by market capitalization. Who knows if the stock is up or down appropriately for that, but certainly a tremendously dominant company. So, but what is it? What is it about Apple that has really, really caused them to have individuals not just buying their products, because in fact, not that many of us did early on, but certainly defending their products and, frankly, everything the company does for such a long time. I mean, the thing where I almost wonder if it started is with Guy Kawasaki, actually, way back when he did The Macintosh Way. Remember that? Because he outlined what it was like to be a Mac user. And I think people read that book and said, oh, either this is me or I really want to be like this. And that sort of started the cult, if it, as it were. I mean, Jeff, do you have a sense of did you read The Macintosh Way when it came out, or
I don't remember reading it, no.
you may, oh, you haven't read it yet? Oh, in that case, never mind. Joe, you read it there.
Well, I read it.
No spoilers, please.
Why else would I have called my first book The Nicest Way?
I read it
As a
too.
nod to that.
But I go further back, and I remember Apple coming out with this beige little slab thing, that was a computer in the late 70s, the Apple II. And that had a fan base and a following as well. Do you remember the Apple II Forever people? Because they really were there.
Well, Matt, you were a big 2C fan.
Yes, I was, and it was very difficult to get me off of that. I didn't switch. I mean, it was you personally, Adam, who introduced me to the Mac, and I still thought it was sort of a toy and kind of silly. And that's part of what Guy Kawasaki was trying to do in the Macintosh way and say, no, I know you think this is very silly because all it does is it has this mouse and you can have like 45 fonts in one sentence and you have like a draw program, a paint program. I know you think that's completely ridiculous, but it's not. It's really cool and it's the way of the future. It did need a kind of evangelist because to a lot of us out there, it was just a toy. And to a lot of us out there, it stayed just a toy. Right. I mean, I still thought it was that Apple was doing something fairly silly, right down through Mac OS 9, because it had a proprietary operating system, and that's just a crazy idea. And sure enough, later on, when they switched over to Unix, the world breathed a sigh of relief. It was like they were growing up and coming into the real world. So for a long time, Apple did look like a toy. It did occupy a kind of side segment in the world, and it did need a kind of defense. Now the shoe's on the other foot. It's like anytime I say anything good about Apple, my Linux using friends go, "Oh, you're just a fanboy." It's like I'm not even allowed to be positive for any reason.
Well, I do think there was, it may have been seemed as like toy, but I mean, you think about the advertising back then, certainly the message that Apple was giving out was that of, personal growth with the Mac. I mean, the power to be your best, or as we all said, the power to crush the other kids.
I did spent a lot of time doing computer support at a major university in the humanities, and was at that time it was very interesting to watch who would gravitate to the PCs and who would gravitate to the Macs, because we'd engineered a couple of grants from IBM and from Apple, and let them duke it out, on the North Campus at UCLA. And there was a very different sort of personality type attracted to the Mac. People who had no sense of humor went to the PCs. Yeah, damn it, I'm a scholar, I've got work to get done, blah, blah, blah. people who wanted to play with their work and kind of enjoyed what they were doing tended to gravitate more towards the Mac. And it was a very interesting sort of cultural division.
I think you have a really good point there. And this may be less true today, but the Mac was always the platform for people who just, you know, they don't have time for crap. They just want to get their work done and have some fun doing it. Whereas, you know, at least in the olden days, Windows was for the, you got to really mess with the machine.
Well, you know, we're going back to OS 2 and DOS 4 and 5, you know, so.
Sure. But I mean, I think there was something about that, you know, yeah. The sort of, at least, you know, in years gone by, the sort of stereotypical Mac user was the Justin Long, you know, the more laid back person was maybe, you know, the Democrat versus the Republican or whatever. I've heard all these different sort of ways of categorizing how the sort of stereotype falls. The Mac user is. But I think that this idea that we are the people who don't take ourselves too seriously, we're going to actually enjoy using our machines versus those other guys who are just, you know, so uptight. That was
the Joe Friday
sort of concept that we can sort of rally around.
But I think the beleaguered thing is also very important. We went through a period where the Apple market share was tiny, tiny. Windows just dominated. I mean, Michael, you know, I had the same academic experience, but academe was a very, very special place. I mean, Swarthmore, mm-hmm. when I was teaching at Swarthmore, it was like they were a Mac shop because they just made a decision that they were going to go with Macs. When I arrived as a new teacher, there was a Mac on my desk. It was like, mm-hmm. you know, and we have a, and they had a Mac a network, and they were, you know, they had Mac networked printers, and they were supporting right. Macs. You know what I mean? That was a very special decision. I was completely unaware of the fact at the time that in the business world, you know, in the actual user world, Windows owned, you know, 98% of the desktop.
Yeah, in my case, we actually were able to let faculty choose which one. So you got a very interesting laboratory experiment going on there.
Well, I think that's sort of key in the larger picture, because that choice is what was important. If you were, you know, going to go work at a normal job, like your computer was probably provided for you, and you got, you know, an IBM clone, you know, or a, you know, OS 2 box or something like that. And I think this continues today. We're seeing it in enterprise and things where the Mac is a choice, like the people who buy Macs have chosen to use the Mac for whatever reason. And so that choice sort of makes it more special, more interesting. And now we see things like, you know, people are choosing to buy iPads and then they bring them into companies, and companies have to deal with the fact that there are now iPads on the network and things like that. So even, you know, back in the day, lots of days, you know, like to have a Mac SE, that was like, okay, I'm going to do this thing because I'm creative, or, you know, because I, you know, want to have something that I can have at home and not, you know, some big hulking metal box running Windows or DOS or whatever. And even then, like, you made the choice and you identified with that brand and the other people who are also making a similar choice.
Here's an interesting point, though, because I think you actually are onto something there with the choice concept, that you were choosing the Mac, certainly, but it felt more as though in the past you were making more choices. In fact, you had to choose which word processor you were going to use, and you had to choose your email program, and you had to choose your web browser and things like that, because it wasn't all just provided to you in the box. And for people who did this, those of us who had been around for a long time, having that choice, having those options was a big deal. That was kind of the, you know, that felt like part of the reason why we were buying into the platform, why we were trying to say, hey, you've got options here. And there's that, almost that that sense of kind of pranksterism. I mean, I was joking, it was like, it's the ghost of Woz. you know, that you could do really fun things on the Mac. Maybe they were related to work, maybe they were not, but it was a way of bringing it, as you say, some of that fun back into it, making it all about you. And that's something which I feel like is disappearing more and more from the Mac. And from Apple's approach in general. It's much more, here's how things are going to be because we know better.
But I took Jeff's remarks in a slightly different way, namely that you were making a choice, and once you'd made it, you'd gone onto a bifurcated path. I had a very hard time getting my parents to switch from Windows to Mac. You know, I told them. I had to bully them. I said to them, this is not actionable. I said to them, I can't support your computer use unless you're using the same computer I am. If you will use the same computer and the same system I am, you can phone me up anytime and I will assist you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you see what the problem was? Once you were into one of these worlds, you were in that world with that way of doing things, with that set of software, and you were afraid to move. The world was very much, it was like the world of chess or the world of some other game that divides things up very sharply. Now we're in a much more Go-like world where there's some territory over here and some territory over here and some territory over here, and all of these stones could be gone in an instant, and somebody could make a wall over here that you didn't even see forming. And we have to be willing to admit that someone is just going to say, no, I'm tired of the iPhone. I'm going to switch to a Samsung. And people will just do it. We're living in a more nimble world.
But that's, I would actually argue that if that's true, and I'm not entirely certain that it is, that's what a huge amount of what all the companies are trying to prevent with platform lock-in. That once you've bought into the Apple platform or the Android platform, or in some ways even like the Amazon platform, you know, they want to make sure that you're going to stay within that at all times.
Mm-hmm.
They
want to keep you out there.
Then there's also a scale factor to that too, because if you are going to be locked into, you know, an iPhone infrastructure, you're probably spending $200 to get a phone, you know, on contract, whatever, and your contract is up. And if for whatever reason you don't want to use the iPhone, or there's something about a Samsung Galaxy Droid, whatever the hell this week's name is, you know, if there's something about that really appeals to you, you're really sort of only out a couple $100. We'll ignore all the money you're spending to the carrier because that's just kind of invisible. Whereas before, it was like, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to spend, you know, $3,000 on a computer and maybe, you know, $300 or $400 for a printer. And like that was sort of bigger financial lock-in than, oh, you know what, my contract's up, I'm just going to get a new phone that's only a couple of $100.
That's only if you're not including all the media and the apps and the usage patterns.
But in the old days, the old days, the Mac could be a center of one's computing experience. You had a Mac. But now we've got a multiplicity of screens and access points into both our stuff and the internet and everything else. And it's no longer a center, a locus that it used to be.
Yes, I want to take that. I want to go even further.
Sure.
I want to raise a sort of another way of cutting across this issue, and that's the uniqueness question. When I started using a Mac, when I resisted using a Mac, when you were my student, and you were trying to show me, look, you can do things with Microsoft Word, and I was just rolling my eyes and saying, watch this,
right now,
dude,
right now.
with my 2C,
and Nisus.
Or whatever. But what was I resisting? What I was resisting was I've got a tool. I had a tool on the Apple IIc called Gutenberg that was amazing. It could do Greek. It could lay out things in a book-like way. It could do all kinds of wonderful formatting. What moved me on? So there was a uniqueness thing. I had a tool, and it was only in one place. Mm-hmm. Then what happened is in like 1989, 1990, HyperCard 2 came out. And I was like, okay. With this, I can really do some cool stuff for my students. I can build interactive testing modules and things like that for Greek. So that's what moved me over to the Macintosh. And again, it was a uniqueness thing. There was nothing like that over in the Windows world. So throughout our history, we've had these unique tools. But now I think that's not so true. I mean, I would argue, maybe I'm just playing the devil's advocate, that whole uniqueness thing is gone. I really feel like all the tools that I use, I could probably just, for all the work that I do, I could just probably drop the platform that I'm working on, pick up another platform, and find a comparable way to do that. I think I could, you know, I can pick up a, I've never used Linux in my life, but I feel like I could probably just pick up a Linux box and be completely comfortable and be accomplishing the very same kind of thing, doing the same kind of writing that I'm doing right now in tools that are very similar in a week, except for TextMate. I would really miss TextMate.
Joe, how about you? I mean, do you feel that what you're doing is only possible on a Mac now, or only possible in the Apple ecosystem?
That's certainly less true than it used to be. I do, you know, of course I have Windows on my Mac, written books about it. There are the things that I need to do most frequently, I still feel are easier to do on the Mac than on Windows. If I didn't have access to a Mac, I obviously, with Windows 8, I would feel much less upset having to make that my primary platform than I would, you know, Windows 95 or something. I would miss certain things, but fundamentally, you know, get my work done. For me, it's a combination of somewhat greater, you know, greater comfort and being used to the tools and you know, honestly, platform lock-in, because I have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Apple devices within 18 inches of me. And, you know, all the apps and all the, you know, iCloud and all the everything, I can use Windows, and I do almost every day for at least a little bit for certain things without pain. But switching over entirely would be not only just to Windows, but, you know, Android and so forth. That would be a real, real hassle.
So I guess the question is, I've frozen, there we go. I guess the question is, though, is the Apple platform supporting that need for productivity? And I say platform fairly specifically because we can say, well, gee, is Apple supporting my productivity? And the answer is maybe not so much, but that's never in some ways been their goal, that they made a platform and for other people to do that. But I think with, you know, the kinds of software that Apple's putting out, for instance, you don't see a competitor for iTunes, you know, there aren't really new competitors for Pages and Numbers, and, you know, maybe that's some of Microsoft owning the market too, but it feels as though those fields have just kind of plateaued, and, you know, you just don't see much innovation, you know, mail apps, web browsers, you know, it's all pretty much settled down on what we've got and what Apple's providing us, and no one really seems to be interested in taking Apple on in that regard, so that we're going to stick with what Apple's going to give us.
Yeah, you know, there are certainly isolated examples of companies that are making Apple-only products that are really useful and really cool, but that's the problem, is that they're isolated. And, you know, let's just take BB Edit, okay? So because we all use BB Edit, and there are perfectly good text editors on Windows. There aren't any that are, you know, quite like BB Edit. But if, you know, but then again, well, I'm afraid I'm going to dig myself into a hole that I can't get out of. You know, you know, there's like, you know, the BB Edit and the Nicest Writer, and you know, but there aren't enough tools that are Mac only that have such an increase in usefulness and such a you know, there's such an improvement over the next nearest thing you could get on Windows
and correct me if I'm wrong, and you're not saying that we're not seeing new stuff coming along to keep pushing that.
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking about programs that have been around for 20 years more.
Right. Now, of course, you know, there are programs that come along from time to time. Everybody goes, oh, you know, that's really cool. You know, everything that the Omni Group puts out, and you know, there are things. I just don't. I can't say that it's a platform wide thing. I can't say that it's a trend. I can't say that, you know, there's a proliferation of apps that are particularly good on the Mac platform.
Well, but isn't part of the problem here that the customer's relationship to software has changed? I mean, our expectations of what software will do and how much it's going to cost have completely changed with the coming of iOS devices and ridiculously cheap software. You know, we're reluctant to pay a dollar. It's like, no, I'm going to get something free. A dollar? That's insane.
But there's also the change from having your Mac as being your workplace with all of your documents in front of you to a much more distributed world where your documents are honestly in the cloud. People are doing a lot more web-enabled stuff. A large part of productivity in business has to do with web-based or network-based systems, and nothing resides on the client side. People are used now to having a much more distributed world, and that means you can move from platform to platform a little bit more easily as a result.
So you can lock into
certain types of media with your Kindles, with your iBooks and the DRM, but generally speaking, in terms of productivity, much of that productivity outside of the creative realms that you and I might work in are distributed.
So let's go take the next step, though, which is Apple's no longer beleaguered. You know, a lot of what Apple's providing is not unique in the way that it used to be unique. You know, they're in fact doing things with platform lock-in that may prevent us from doing what we want. Certainly, you know, cutting down on inter-application communication by requiring sandboxing, that kind of thing. Cutting down on our options, cutting down on our choices. We're not seeing the same kind of messages coming out of Apple. We don't, you know, it isn't Think Different anymore. It's the, I mean, I don't know if you've looked at the recent iPhone ads. It's the, oh, look, you can turn on Do Not Disturb. Ooh, isn't that nice? You know, it's not about doing something new or doing something, you know, amazing that you couldn't have done before. And so the question is why is Apple still getting all of this support from the community? They don't need that kind of defense anymore. And it's not like they're throwing a bone back to the longtime users who've been sticking with Apple all this time. Why are they so popular still in some ways, you know, with the people who have to defend them from every you know, every silly attack that happens in the press?
One of the theories that I threw out during our pre-show banter, and you know, there were several, and you can take this or leave this, was that, you know, it's like we were the underdog political party for so many years. The other guys had the majority, and now finally, after, you know, all of this struggle, you know, now we are the majority, and we still feel that is we, the people who have been doing this for a long time. Now we feel like it's almost too good to be true. We have a really tenuous grasp on this sort of majority power position, and we don't want to lose it. And so we are sort of going a little bit overboard to try to protect this newly found status, lest it disappear again.
Isn't this, however, sort of the same thing as in the political world, though, where, you know, Obama gets elected and everyone who was a huge Obama fan is yay, really happy and everything like that. The world's never going to be the same. And then it turns out that it is still more or less the same world where Obama is not perfect and he doesn't accomplish all the things he said he was going to, and et cetera, et cetera, and vice versa on the other side.
Yes, and it puts the, you know, supporters of you know, your company or your party in a kind of unfortunate position, because, you know, what we all, I mean, maybe this isn't obvious to anyone who might be reading or watching this, but all of us have a lot, there are a lot of things about Apple that really, really irritate us. I mean, we spend a lot of our time sort of complaining about all the things Apple is doing wrong and all the things that are broken with Apple apps and services and software. We keep using it, but we really dislike it. Now, you know, you support a political candidate, and then, you know, you put all this effort into convincing other people to vote for this person, and the person takes office, and it's like, oh, well, you know, I still like this guy's platform better than the other guy's platform, but I'm really kind of disappointed in what I see. And there's this sort of tension of like, well, I don't really want to admit this to my friends. You know, I don't want to admit this to the people that I convinced to vote for this guy, because I was sort of portraying him as, no, you know, this is the thing, you know? And so it's kind of the same way with Apple, having worked so hard to push this, even though we see, of course, yes, there are disappointments and things that we wish were different, and that Apple was actually paying attention to us and listening to our ideas, it's kind of hard to say, well, you know, actually, I take back all those complimentary things that I said.
Isn't there also a problem with the premium price? I mean, when something is that much more expensive than you think it really needs to be, because Apple's taking such a big cut on all this hardware, aren't we all just riddled with cognitive dissonance? It's like, you know, it's like someone asked me, you remember my new car, Adam, when you were here, and it's like someone asked me, do you love your new car? And I said, well, of course I love my new car. I just spent a ridiculous number of tens of thousands of dollars for it. You know, naturally you're going to love that, because to admit that you don't love it, you'd be at war with yourself. You wouldn't be able to live with your inner being. And mm-hmm. I wonder whether there isn't some of that involved here too.
And of course, that's not just happened, you know, with one purchase of an expensive computer, but it's happened over and over and over and over again as we've, you know, upgraded our computers and bought into the iPhones and the iPads and things like that, so that it'd be really hard to do that. Michael, yeah.
But there's also an emotional and an aesthetic dimension to it that makes people fans and want their stuff. The fact is, their stuff looks and feels damn good. And there's a certain, you know, and you can justify saying that I like the feel of the quality of just the physicality of it. Their Macs are beautiful. Their iPhones are beautiful. The iPad's a lovely looking device. And, you know, you can look at a lot of other devices by other manufacturers, and very few of them have quite that style and grace to them across the product line. And so that invokes in us an emotional response to Apple, much like we would have to a celebrity whose face and performance we like and we identify with.
They're pretty, they're cool. Even though it means they're mean, even though they're mean to their dog.
Exactly. You know, we feel a sense of emotional connection because they provide us with a visceral and aesthetic pleasure.
So, well, piggybacking on that, I think I'll be the first to sort of dispute what I'm going to say, which doesn't make much sense.
Jeff at war with himself.
Oh my God, Matt's done this to my brain.
Yes.
I mean, like, you know, one big criticism that people have of Apple as well, it's all marketing, and people, you know, just believe whatever's is being put out there, and that's why you have so many people who love Apple, because Apple's marketing is so good. And while I think that's mostly bull, there's a grain of truth in it, in the sense that at least, you know, since the Macintosh being the computer for the rest of us, Apple's message and marketing and everything has all been about, we're making this thing for you, whether this is a computer, an iPhone, or whatever. Like, this is for you. This is not the box that a company is going to buy 700 of, and we're going to have a good quarter, you know. And it, granted, that happens, and there are companies that buy Macs and all of that, but the message and the focus, and I think that comes through in the design and the branding and the messaging, is that, you know, Apple is doing something for you, not for customers, not for users, but for, you know, Joe and Adam and Matt and Michael. And that, I think, really instills a lot of, you know, loyalty, because, you know, not to anthropomorphize too much, but, you know, Apple is your friend. Your friend. I know.
Now I'm sounding like your friend. That's one of the rules we've learned.
You've really talked yourself into a box here.
No. That's just it. You think Apple is your friend. Apple wants you to think that Apple is your friend. Your friends sometimes do stupid things. And your friends are sometimes not very nice to you, but they're
not my friends.
They're
not my better friends. It don't last very long, let me tell you.
Okay, yes, maybe I have some dysfunctional.
I think you have a good point, Jeff, which is that Apple, that right, everything Apple has done, they've targeted at the individual, and that for a long time didn't really work. I mean, frankly, it didn't really work until they came out with a device that was small enough and cheap enough in terms of the iPhone for it really to be a personal device.
I would say the iMac too.
I think this has been true for a long time. They've always had this, you know, the power to be your best. You know, the Think Different was very much aimed at, you know, aren't you different? You know, you're thinking outside the box by using a Mac. They've long done this, but mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, when you see Apple take off, really it's because of the iPhone, because that's the first time they've been able to get truly into your hand and into your head.
Well, I think isn't the elephant in this room Steve Jobs, the late great Steve Jobs? I mean, look.
The ghost of Steve Jobs now.
There was just this article in the New Yorker, in New York Times, like yesterday, day before, comparing Apple with Samsung. And I thought it was a very enlightening article. I mean, I'm not sure how accurate it was, but one of the things that they pointed out is Samsung does a lot of market research. They bring in a lot of people and see what they want. Apple's whole thing and Steve Jobs' whole thing was the public doesn't know what it wants. That's my job, is to show them something they've never seen before, and they go, oh, who would have thunk it? And by golly, that's exactly what they did. From the day Steve Jobs came back to Apple after being fired, he did a series of unbelievably surprising things. Every time he did one, I personally said, this is completely stupid. This is an insane thing he's doing, and no one's going to want it. And I was completely wrong every single time. And I got exponentially wrong. So there were those iMacs that came in colors, and I was like, no. And they saved the company. And then there was OS X, and I was like, no, no, no. And it saved the company. And then there was the iPod and iTunes, and I was like, no. And it saved the company. And then there was like the iPhone. I was like, phone? Who uses a phone? You know, and it saved the company. So, I mean, I was always wrong. Now that's not there.
So, Matt, you're the anti-analyst. So what should Apple not do next?
Well, it shouldn't lose its way, and that's exactly what I think it is doing. I mean, right now, I think Apple is thrashing. You know, I'm just going to repeat what I've said before. Even on the last Hangout that I was on, I said this. I've submitted more bug reports on iOS 6 than on all previous versions of iOS combined. This is a very confused operating system. This last set of changes, iOS 6, what's new in iOS 6 is like mud pies being thrown at the system from all directions. It's got no guiding principle, and it's not leading into the future. It's just a bunch of patches. And the last time I saw this was 1996, and I said, this company is going down the tubes, and I was absolutely right, except that a very surprising thing happened. Steve Jobs came back and saved the company.
So, I don't know, I mean, sort of don't know where we've gotten, but it does feel as though the world's changing, and Apple's changing. And, you know, how much of that is related to the people who have been using and supporting the products either for a long time, or maybe it's all about the people who are doing it now? I mean, does the company actually rely on that? I mean, people are saying, you know, really it's, oh, Apple, you know, could be gone tomorrow. Is that really true? I mean, is a company with Apple's level of dominance at this point, are they really vulnerable to anything from the outside in a significant way?
Not in a short term. Google Hangout jinx. But, okay, look at Microsoft. Microsoft is you know, still very much a powerhouse, very profitable and all of that. But I think the general consensus is Microsoft is kind of a waning company that is you know, on the ropes. I mean, they're not on the ropes in the sense that Apple was, where they only had, what, like 3 months of payroll and then they would have had to shut their doors. But, you know, Microsoft is no longer the innovator. So, you know, could Apple end up like that in 5 years? Maybe. Yeah. If they're, you know, arrogant and don't, I don't know, don't embrace the spirit of Jobs.
Well, see, here's the thing, right? I mean, what they have to do is they have to actually not ship things that people want to buy. I mean, I was just looking up, you know, Microsoft's last quarter revenues, $21 billion in revenue, and you know, $7.7 billion in profits. Not exactly a company that's irrelevant. And yet, yes,
they'll be gone next year.
Feel as though they're thrashing. So, you know, there's something that Apple has right now. They have some sort of magic sauce or magic pixie dust that whenever they sprinkle it on some new product, it sells like crazy. And that seems to be overriding these other issues that we've been saying, you know, hey, you're not making me more productive. Hey, your software is having more and more problems. Hey, you seem to be losing some overall guiding light, you know, and whether or not that's Steve Jobs, I don't know, because I mean, I'm not sure that Steve necessarily was, you know, the reason why software was better or anything like that. He was mostly good, I think, at sort of identifying the products people wanted. But nonetheless, you know, there is stuff does seem to be changing.
Here's a question. Imagine that everything did go wrong, that Apple exhausted its supply of pixie dust, and, you know, it had a sucky year, and support for his products started dropping off. Now, this 5 years from now, things have gone so bad that Apple is back to being beleaguered. In this hypothetical future, would the people who rallied so hard to support Apple when it was beleaguered before, and who have kept on defending it in its, you know, its brightest days, would those people once again leap to Apple's defense, or at that point think, because things have sort of leveled out so much, and because the other platforms are really pretty good and pretty usable, would people kind of say, you know, screw it, I'll just use the other guy's stuff and let Apple die? I mean, that to me is sort of the crux of the question: is this enthusiasm about, you know, defending Apple, would it sustain yet another
death spiral?
Yeah.
In other words, we were down here and we were all, you know, very, very positive about Apple, even when Apple was having troubles and, you know, everything. And then when Apple starts going up, in some sense, it's easy to stay along with the ride.
Right.
Yes. But what happens when you go back down the other side?
That's my question.
If you feel like you've been abandoned during some of the top points.
Right on.
And that's a very good question.
Well, the real question is, will there be a fan base powerful enough to help boost them back up? I think that's what Joe's asking.
But I think the real question...
The same people, because I'll be 65 or so when that happens, and I probably won't care that much anymore.
But I think the real question is, do we need a fan base? I mean, Adam, isn't the thing you really want to ask, isn't the whole overarching question here, what's with the rabid fanboyism in the first place? Why can't Apple users just be Apple users? This is what I was saying before about the difference between a chess game and a Go game. What the heck would be so, you know, Apple makes this phone, and it's got the first real smartphone. And all of a sudden, it turns out smartphones are a really good idea, and Apple's got it. But there's no law that says other people can't go, oh, you're right, that is a good idea, and make a smartphone and capture a piece of that market, maybe a large piece of that market. And my question is, what the heck is wrong with that? What the heck would be so terrible if Apple had 30% of the smartphone market, and Samsung had 30%, and some company we've never heard of had 30%? That makes 100, right?
No, I think that's certainly a good point. And I almost wonder. I feel like I'm too deep in this, so I don't really know. Are there other industries where people are as rabid about their companies, their, you know, the products they like as much as Apple?
Why can't there be, you know, only one baseball team? Why do there have to be like 24 in each division and a whole fan base for each one? You know, does it really matter what team you root for? And it's something like that. I mean, that plays it into a very basic human need to form hierarchies and tribes.
Well, maybe that's part of my irritation, is that I gave up on caring in the slightest bit about professional sports about 20 years ago.
Sports is one example, but people do form tribes. It's a very ingrained part of what it means to be a human being.
I think we have families, grand saloons.
Identify with. It's what we do. Why do we do it with a company? There's a whole lot of sociological investigation about that, but it's something that people do. Apple just happens to have profited greatly from it, leveraged it in a fantastically interesting way.
And is there any way that those of us who fall into that category can in any way affect what Apple is doing to make sure that it remains our tribe? Yeah.
Well, affect Apple. Oh, you're so funny.
Easy one. Easy.
That's a chaos butterfly question. It could.
Well, I think that if we were to follow Joe's hypothetical, it would entirely depend on the product. You know, if Apple takes a nosedive, I think it'll be because of, you know, quality control and bad products and, you know, misguided direction and all the things that you know we're seeing little slivers of and that we're hoping that they do something about. Because, you know, way back when, I think Apple still had a very good product, a very good idea that we all supported, especially compared to, you know, the alternatives. And that's why a lot of us stuck with it. And, you know, if in, you know, several years, other companies have finally caught up, and then they're starting to do this now and can deliver, you know, a tablet that is actually a decent thing, then, you know, maybe that won't be as much of an issue. I think another big thing is that right now Apple is benefiting greatly from the fact that most of its competitors don't know what the hell they're doing, and they have, you know, 3 or 4 years head start on their competitors. If you know, Microsoft had you know, done a Surface 4 years ago that was actually good, we'd probably be having a different conversation, because I think there'd be a little bit more parity in the markets. And so, you know, Apple has had a really amazing period where they came out of the gate with an idea, the iPhone and iOS, and they've been able to run with it, and other companies have really had to try to catch up, and it's starting to get closer. So, you know, will Apple do the thing that they did long time ago, which was like, oh, well, you know, we're so successful and you know, the stock price is so high that everything we're doing must be great, and, you know, the communication from users and from, you know, middle managers and people isn't bubbling up, then, yeah, I can see them falling down.
Well, I think what you just described is what they're doing right now. I mean, that's exactly why iOS 6 is the way it is, why Maps was the way that it was. I mean, Tim Cook basically, you know, his public statements prove to me that we all knew something that Tim Cook didn't know, and that's very bad. That means you've got a dysfunctional, overly large corporation.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, obviously, the big rumors this week have been the iWatch, but personally, I'm looking forward to, you know, if we're going to have to do separate into tribes, I'm looking for, you know, the iCar to face off against Google's self-driving car. clearly we need to have, you know, the next religious war. But in the meantime, I think we'll end it there. So thank you all for chatting about this. I don't know that we've determined anything, but it's still been interesting to kind of ponder some of these concepts about why Apple is popular, was popular, still is popular, may remain popular, or maybe not so. And until next time, thanks for joining us.